The latest issue's Etc. journal contains a confession. It's about my problem with the commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You can read it by subscribing to the issue's Etc. journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The latest journal also details Pastor Will Wheaton's journey on the Wittenberg Trail. Subscribe to the online Issues Etc. journal today, issuesetc.org.
I don't think God's through with me. I really believe He thinks there's still some good things I can do.
We would like to tell the president to reconsider his position. 90% of the African-American vote went for him because he was American dream. He was a result of the civil rights movement. And just like he listened to the homosexuals, give us an ear.
Nicification happens when leaders and laity start assuming that our primary role is to be very nice, even at the expense of objective truth.
We have this crazy idea in the Missouri Synod that when pastors get a call, all of a sudden the Holy Ghost is going to talk to them over the next couple weeks about what they're supposed to do or what God's telling them.
Thank you for providing theology for clerical collar, white collar, and blue collar.
Christianity is true, not in that true for me but not for you sense, but objectively true. And it's not just truth, capital T. It is capital T truth made up of many things that are true. And Christianity claims that this truth isn't just a matter of history. It certainly is a matter of history, but it's more than history. This truth enters history. This truth changes the history of this fallen world permanently in the person of Jesus Christ. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joining us in this hour to begin a three-part daily series on the Christian worldview is Ken Samples. He's senior research scholar for Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California, and author of the new book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. Ken, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. It's good to be with you.
There are a lot of ideas, a lot of truths in the Christian faith. Why, theologically and apologetically, is it wise to begin with the truth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ?
Well, that's a really good question. And, Todd, I think the reason that I thought this is the place to begin is I think the resurrection of Jesus is Christianity's most dangerous idea. A dangerous idea is an idea that turns the apple cart upside down. It's revolutionary. It's shocking. And with the all of these books coming out by the new atheists, I thought that where Christianity stands at odds with that naturalist worldview is our view of death. I mean, naturalism says if you're an atheist, you're going to die. You're going to die soon. You're going to die alone, and you're going to be dead forever. And nothing anybody says or does will ever change that. It is a hopeless worldview from my vantage point. Now, a naturalist might say, yeah, but it could still be true. But I think that right at the heart of Christianity is this message that Jesus conquered death. And it is the evidence for our faith. And if Jesus conquered death, if he was publicly crucified and 3 days later rose from the dead, then, Todd, there's no message more important for people to hear than that message about Jesus Christ. And so I thought it really is the most shocking, revolutionary, dangerous idea, and dangerous because it's so contrary to the naturalist perspective and really to all other perspectives.
Is it also important because at least the major biblical proponent, aside from Christ himself, of Christ's resurrection, the major apologist or proclaimer of it, St. Paul, says that if it isn't true, that is Christ's resurrection, then, well, the rest of it might be true in some sense, but it doesn't really matter.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's my second reason for putting it right there in the front, that Christianity is it is an amazing faith. It's a dangerous faith because hypothetically, there's a way to falsify Christianity, just produce the body and it's over. And as I've thought about other worldviews, particularly religious worldviews, Buddhism and Hinduism, how do you falsify those religions? It's much more difficult. I think Christianity is a bold faith because the Apostle Paul straightforwardly tells us if Christ hasn't been risen, our faith is vain, we're still in our sins. So I thought, yes, this is such a bold idea that, I think it is Christianity's most dangerous idea.
What particular, this is more general before we get into the resurrection itself and the claims there, what particular challenges does a kind of relativistic postmodern way of thinking, and it is, I don't even know if you could call it a way of thinking, it's a way of avoiding thinking in some cases, but what particular challenges does that pose to the presentation of these central and dangerous ideas of the Christian worldview?
Well, I think that, I think this issue of truth, I mean, Christians should approach this question and say, you know, truth is sacred to the Christian. I mean, we believe that God has made us in his image. He has given us the ability to, I like what Calvin said. Calvin said, because we're made in the image of God, we're able to hunt and gather the truth. And I think that what the problem that arises in kind of a multicultural context where everybody has their own truths and anybody's truth is good as anybody else's truth is it really takes away from this very sharp attention to truth, that God is the ultimate truth and we're made in his image and we're able to grasp that truth. And so I think that postmodernism poses many challenges, relativism and pluralism, but I do think anything that takes attention away from truth with a capital T when it comes to our faith is something we have to battle against.
I mean, in that sense, the worldview that you mentioned at the outset, naturalism, and I'd like you to detail it a little bit more, it is at least, we are at least in the same room, because naturalism does say that there is T with the capital, or truth with a capital T, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think naturalism and historic Christianity can have a clear communication. I mean, I think the worldviews are clear. Naturalism is the worldview that says the material physical universe is all there is. It's the sole reality. There's no spiritual realm. There's no immortal souls, no angel, no a spiritual, tripersonal God, all of that is ruled out. So everything is the product of matter and energy and the properties associated with it. And I think that this interaction between materialism or naturalism and Christianity does come to the fore. And I think that the relativistic idea gets in the way of that. I think the good news, though, Todd, is that the Apostle Paul had to battle with relativism in the first century, pluralism. So the first century and the 21st century are not all that different. And Christianity spread and flourished in the first century. I'm convinced it can do it again in the 21st century.
With a few minutes before we take our first break here, Ken, you say that naturalism has a fourfold existential predicament. You outlined it at the very beginning, but go back over that. I will die soon, I will die alone, and I'm going to be dead forever. Why is that a predicament?
I mean, think about that. I'm in my 50s now. When I was a boy, I thought, you know, I'm going to have many days of my life. I didn't recognize that, boy, life is so short, and from a naturalist point of view, there's no God. There's no life after death. There's no ultimate meaning to life. Maybe you can subjectively give your life some meaning. But, I mean, think of the repercussions of that. We're here for this very tiny moment, and so I'm going to die, and it's going to be soon, and I can't slow it down, and I'm going to have to do it alone. I can't pay somebody to do it for me, and I'm going to be dead forever. I mean, Todd, I don't think that enough people think about the implications of a worldview like that. And in fact, I'm not sure people really can. I think we quickly move away from it because it's so shocking and so startling. But if naturalism is true, there's no way of getting around it. And I'm trying to get somebody's attention by putting it in those very stark terms.
And I mean, what you're saying here, Ken, is that naturalism leaves us in a meaningless universe, a meaningless existence. That's the answer to the existential predicament, meaninglessness.
Yes. And how does anybody live with that? I mean, how do you live without hope? How do you live without meaning? How do you live without some eschatological hope and purpose? And Christianity is such a powerful contrast to that. It is a faith of hope, the resurrection. You know, everybody who's lived on this planet has died or will die, but one died a public death and didn't stay dead. Wow, if that's true, everybody's got to hear that message. Nothing more important than hearing that message.
With only a minute here, you say that, just as a side note, naturalism really requires not that I simply say this of myself, that I will die, I'll die soon, remain dead forever, but it says it of the whole cosmos. What do you mean?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm going to die, you're going to die, humanity's going to go extinct, our hospitable planet will come apart, the galaxies will collide. Ultimately, there is a heat death where the universe will be cold and dark, and here again is that existential powerful statement, Todd, nothing anybody thinks, says, or does will change it. That is, I think, a hopeless worldview, which makes me think atheism is it's a philosophy for young people, because once you get a little older, you realize, wow, that's a difficult worldview to swallow.
Ken Samples is our guest. He's senior research scholar at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California. He's author of the new book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. We're beginning with the foundational truth, the one upon which all the truths of the Christian faith rest, ultimately, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And when we come back from this break, we're going to look at the firsthand evidence, which there is. This isn't an idea someone came up with. This is an event that allegedly occurred. And those who allege that it occurred say they actually saw it. They witnessed it. We'll go over their accounts after this. The latest issues, etc. journal contains a confession. It's about my problem with the commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You can read it by subscribing to the Issues Etc. Journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The latest journal also details Pastor Will Wheaton's journey on the Wittenberg Trail. Subscribe to the online Issues Etc. Journal today, issuesetc.org.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world?
India.
Sweden.
Egypt.
France.
Turkey.
Japan.
Australia.
Canada.
United Kingdom.
Hong Kong.
Austria.
Finland.
Malaysia.
Singapore.
Bulgaria.
Korea.
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Ken Samples is our guest. Beginning a three-part daily series on the Christian worldview today, the resurrection and incarnation of Jesus Christ. Let's go over some of the And I'll say here, just for the sake of argument, and solely for the sake of argument, that men allege the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so if something is alleged, we ought to check out how it is they allege this and how it and what it is they claim they saw. Where is the evidence for us, Ken?
Well, I think this is a very interesting way of looking at truth claims. I mean, Christianity says that that everything hinges on this life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so the resurrection focuses on these events that took place over a three-day period. The first evidence for the resurrection is the empty tomb, that Jesus' body was not in the tomb. And we know a lot about this tomb. We have several different accounts of what went on there. We know whose tomb it was. It was Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. We also know that, you know, if they could produce the body, the jig would be up. It would be over. And so when you look at the life of Jesus and compare it with some of these other religious leaders, Siddhartha Gautama, Krishna, you don't have this kind of historical, kind of factual element that comes to you. And again, you could short-circuit Christianity right from the get-go, but they couldn't, because what they knew was the tomb was empty. And what we know about this tomb and the people connected with it is consistent with what we know about the first century. So the first solid piece of evidence for the resurrection is they can't produce the body. The tomb is empty, and people witnessed it. They encountered it.
That's the first piece of evidence. And then there is, I mean, if it were only that, we might say, wow, that's pretty remarkable, but I guess you could find other empty tombs. But the claims go beyond an empty tomb, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the second part is even more powerful, these post-mortem appearances. That is, the body that is missing from the tomb that should be in the tomb, this person, Jesus, begins appearing to various people. And Todd, in my book, I give this short catalog of the resurrection appearance. He appears to women and men. He appears to friends and enemies. I mean, if it was just the friends, we might wonder, but he appears to people who are his enemies, to individuals, small groups, large groups. Some of the appearances are indoors, others outside, in the morning, in the evening. One or more of them, he is seen and heard and touched. He drinks with his disciples. He has a physical body. He appears to some people single times, others multiple times. And he has these qualities. Some are supernatural. He's able to perform things that a natural body wouldn't, but he also has a physical body. And so the tomb is empty. There are these appearances that are taking place. And then a third element that is connected with this is this time frame. There's a very short time frame between the events that happened and the eyewitnesses giving testimony to these kinds of events. I mean, if there is a long period of time between when something happens and somebody reports it, well, then naturally people are going to have questions. But I mean, this is a very short time period, so there are solid reasons for believing something extraordinary has happened here with this person of Jesus Christ.
I want to focus just for a second on Thomas, who is... he is among the skeptics, the radical skeptics, to whom Jesus appears.
Yeah, this is, I think, a very powerful area, Todd. This extraordinary transformation of the apostles. I mean, David Hume, the famous Scottish skeptic, he kind of laid down a criteria and said, you know, I can't believe in the resurrection unless there were some really credible people, a sufficient number of people. They have to be very credible people. They have to be the kinds of individuals that would have a combination of moral credibility and education that you could really trust. But, you know, when you look at the major people who experience the resurrection, I mean, you have three of them that are very skeptical right from the get-go. Thomas is one, James, the brother of Jesus, another, and, of course, the Apostle Paul. But, you know, Thomas, he is associated with the apostles. They tell him they've seen the resurrected Lord, but he says, look, I need something more. He has this kind of tough-minded skepticism that so many skeptics are so proud of, but something happens where he sees the resurrected Christ and all of that skepticism is set aside. So he comes from being doubting Thomas to believing Thomas.
And these appearances are both described in a narrative form, but also summarized by St. Paul. Paul is going to make his great apologetic for the resurrection of Christians based upon the resurrection, the singular resurrection of Christ, and he's going to catalog in a briefer form how he kind of fits into the line of eyewitnesses. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is very interesting. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul talks about the resurrection. He gives us this statement, this kind of early creedal statement that Christ died, that he was buried, and that he appeared. And this threefold statement appears multiple times in the New Testament. And he has this list. I mean, you have to be careful about giving lists. People check lists. People can confirm or deny the list. They can confirm it or they can falsify it. But he mentions six prominent witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus. He mentions Peter. He then talks about the 12, more than 500 brothers and sisters. He mentions James, all of the apostles, and then he mentions himself. And Todd, I want to touch upon this question of James, if I could, for a moment. I mean, this is Jesus's half-brother. This is a sibling of Jesus. This is, I've thought a lot about James. I mean, James thinks that his brother is a bipolar. He thinks his brother is delusional. And imagine what it would be like. I mean, I don't know if you've ever felt embarrassed by your family or some of your relatives. I have. I'm sure they've probably been a little embarrassed by me at times, too. But imagine James, that, you know, my brother claims to be the Messiah, the Son of God. And then something happens. I mean, even Mary, with all of the extraordinary experiences concerning the birth of Jesus, Mary and the brothers and sisters, they go to take control over Jesus. But something happens where James becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church. So if there is a pope, James probably has a better pedigree than Peter. And how do we account for this change? How did these skeptical people end up being foremost defenders of Jesus and willing then to even lay down their life? I mean, I think you need a good explanation. The resurrection seems to provide an outstanding explanation.
Are there credible naturalistic explanations for what we're talking about here? First, the empty tomb, then the post, as you say, the post-mortem appearances.
You know, I think a very powerful way of approaching issues, Todd, is what I call, in logic, we call it abductive reasoning. That is, when you look at a series of events, you ask the question, what is the best explanation for those events? What theory would seem to explain all of this data? And I want to say that this kind of abductive reasoning where you move from an event to the best explanation, this is very common. I mean, this is the way detectives reason, lawyers reason that way, doctors look at symptoms and then draw, you know, some kind of diagnosis. This is a very normal and natural way of explaining. I think what is very difficult for the naturalist point of view, for a purely skeptical point of view, is these evidences are very diverse. And whatever you postulate, I mean, let's say you come up with an answer for the empty tomb. Maybe they stole the body. Well, okay, but who's this person making all of these appearances? And then if you go to the appearances and you say, well, maybe they're hallucinating. Well, what about the empty tomb? That is, I think the problem with all of the naturalistic theories is that none of them provides a sufficient range of explanations, as does the resurrection.
So you're basically saying if there is going to be an alternate theory, and we'll talk about some of them on the other side of the break and respond to them briefly. If there's going to be an alternate theory presented here, it has to cover all of the bases, just as the claims, as many bases as the claims cover.
That's exactly right. I mean, we talk about explanatory power and scope. And can you explain this, and how much of this can you explain? And so I would think if I were a naturalist, I'd have to come up with a number of theories and try to meld them together, but there isn't one naturalistic theory that really fits the data, that it really explains the situation in a broad way. And so I think that's one of the biggest problems with all of the naturalist theory. One theory might explain part of this over here, but says nothing about these other events.
All right, when we come back, we'll take up a few of those alternate theories for the resurrection of Jesus Christ with Ken Samples on this Thursday afternoon, the 7th of June. We'll begin with the one that is probably the default position of most. It's not very refined, but many people accept it as, well, this is the best explanation for what happened. It's the legend. That is, enough time passed that people kind of began to think and believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, with no bearing whatsoever on the actual events that are claimed. We'll talk about the legend theory with Ken Samples after this. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
How does the church year teach us the fundamental narratives of salvation's story? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June is Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Church Year. It's written by regular guest Pastor Heath Curtis. You can check out Ordering Our Days in His Peace at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase our Book of the Month by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Ordering Our Days in His Peace.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
One law firm goes head-to-head with healthcare mandates.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
30 years ago, a cloistered nun named Mother Angelica started a small television network in her monastery garage to spread the teachings of the Catholic Church. Over the years, thousands of viewers have enjoyed her wit and humor. But now the network is suing the federal government for the right to remain faithful to those teachings. And lawyers at the Beckett Fund are determined to help. The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty is a nonprofit legal and educational institute that protects religious freedom. This is its third lawsuit challenging the abortion drug mandate.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
We're talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, beginning a three-part daily series On the Christian Worldview, a little bit later, the incarnation of Christ, Ken Samples is our guest. He's senior research scholar at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California, author of the new book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. You can find out more about this book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Ken, the first alternate explanation that you deal with is the legend theory, which to me is kind of the laziest of all of the alternate theories because, to my thinking, it just ignores the documentary and eyewitness evidence.
I think that's true, but I also think you're correct that it's kind of the default view that maybe the way of getting around all of this is that, you know, it happened a long time ago. You know, things get passed on. People put words in the mouth of other people, and therefore nothing really happened of any substance. The problem, however, is that historic Christianity is just that. It's history. And so, you know, it's very difficult to say things didn't happen or just invent things when people are still living who were familiar with the life of Jesus. And so, you know, if James or John or even one of the later disciples of Jesus came along and started just inventing things out of thin air, if there were people still living who were familiar with this, this would not go over. They would be confronted as communicating things that were false. And so when we look at the New Testament, we realize that, you know, these Gospels appear fairly quickly. There is a short period of time between when these events happened and when the Gospels appeared. And so it's very difficult to come up with a purely legendary element. And I would add to that that there are even non-Christian authors writing at the end of the first century, the beginning of the second century, that mention Jesus, Pliny, Tacitus, a variety of people that say, you know, this is what we know about Jesus of Nazareth. He was a Galilean, a great teacher. His disciples said he performed miracles. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. They claimed that he rose from the dead. This heresy, in their mind, has reached Rome, and early Christians worshipped him. So everything we know outside of the New Testament from Jewish authors, Greek and Roman authors, conforms amazingly well with what we find in the New Testament.
There's a series of others that seem to be closely related to it. Sometimes they get mixed in with the legend theory, and that is that the disciples who claim to have witnessed Christ's post-mortem appearances were hallucinating individually or together. Also, I kind of, at least in the conversations I've had with skeptics, they like to mix that in together with maybe, just maybe, they were seeing some sort of a spiritual vision there. But they all seem to amount to the same thing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, whatever explanatory theory, naturalistic explanatory theory, I mean, you know, you think of the hallucination theory. I mean, okay, maybe the early women who went to the tomb, maybe in their grief, you know, maybe they had some kind of psychological reaction to the resurrection based upon this deep sense of loss. But would Paul have an hallucination? Would Thomas? How about James? I mean, the explanatory power that hallucination has is so very limited. It's very difficult to think that 500 people would have the same hallucination. And so even if there is a kernel of truth that might have some explanatory power, it immediately gets hit very hard with the facts and the evidence of the resurrection. And again, even if we relate it to these kind of spiritual visions, what I think is really interesting is that even critical scholars, even scholars that question the truth of the resurrection, they're convinced, for the most part, that these apostles are writing about real events. And that's when you talk about the particulars. Jesus has a body. They're encountering things that don't seem like wild spiritual visions or dreams. They seem like everyday historical events. And so none of these theories, and I've tried to catalog them, they just kind of fall apart once you really scrutinize them.
And kind of a final thought here on the resurrection. To me, it always comes back to the fact that the people who claim to have both witnessed the empty tomb and who claimed to have seen Christ raised bodily from the dead, claim just that. They don't say, in any sense, well, I kind of fell into a trance, and there was Jesus all of a sudden. There's none of that. It is written and recounted in precisely the same way you would recount an encounter with any other person alive.
Yeah, I think you've hit it right on the head. I think when you look at these encounters, there's a problem with the time frame. The time frame is very, very short. And when these apostles talk about these events, they don't talk about some kind of, mystical experience. They don't describe things as if they're having some kind of, drug event. They talk in very clear terms about what they saw, what they heard, what they experienced. Other people are seemingly able to corroborate. And so, I think, Todd, at the end of the day, after 2,000 years, with all of the skepticism that has been thrown at the New Testament and how hard people try to avoid it, that the best explanatory hypothesis is that Jesus actually rose from the dead. And again, that's such an amazing thing. What does that do to us when again, we trace it back to those existential questions of, I'm going to die, I'm going to die soon? The Christian worldview is so radical, and that's really the reason I began the book the way I did. I think, Todd, you and I, and Christians like us, we've celebrated so many Easters that we've kind of gotten used to this idea. It's kind of like going to Washington, D.C. You live in D.C., you see all the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, it becomes kind of part of your culture. I'm just saying we should never get used to this message of the resurrection. It is so radical. It is so revolutionary. It is so dangerous that I'm trying to shake up both the atheist and the Christian.
Moving out from the central truth of the resurrection, the next question that needs answering, I guess, to put it that way, is, well, if this guy, Jesus, in fact, rises bodily from the dead, he's dead at point A and alive again at point B. Who is he? Who did he claim to be? Who did he present himself to be? How does historic Christianity answer that world-changing question?
Well, this is again what I call the most distinctive element of Christianity. Maybe it's the most distinctive dangerous idea. I mean, Christianity makes the radical claim that Jesus was God in human flesh, that Jesus came on the scene of human history, the second person of the Trinity, took to himself a human nature, became what they called in Greek the theanthropos, the God-man. And this amazing element is so powerfully connected with Jesus. I mean, he reaches into the Old Testament and takes the most sacred name for God found in Isaiah and Exodus and applies it to himself, the great I am. He talks about to see me is to see the Father, and I and the Father are one. I mean, this Christianity is all about Christ, Todd. I think you probably could get Buddhist teachings, even if Siddhartha didn't exist, you probably could get ideas from Krishna consciousness, even if Krishna didn't exist. But in Christianity, it's all about Christ. It's all about who he was and what he did. And so this extraordinary claim, in a religious world, who speaks for God? All of these religions, I wish I could have God's point of view. Christianity says that's exactly what you find in Christ. God comes in human flesh and gives his perspective. And I see the incarnation as such a powerful Christian truth claim.
And we need to make sure that we keep it as sharp as it really is, because some people might say, well, what we've got is a man who claimed to be divine in some sense, or claimed to have had an encounter with the divine that left him maybe at a different level of enlightenment as the rest of us. Those fall far short of what Christ actually claimed for himself, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, think about the context. I mean, it would be one thing if Jesus were from India and said, well, I'm claiming to be divine, but of course we all know that everyone is divine. All reality is one. That one reality is God. But the context for Jesus is Judaism. I mean, this stark monotheistic religion that there's one true and living God, and it stands in opposition to all of these pagan polytheistic claims by the Greeks and the Romans. And so for Jesus to cut his teeth reciting the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," and to come and to make the statements that he makes, not only his direct claims, but to say that there are things that only God can do, and Jesus does those things, that he's able to raise the dead and judge humanity, allows people to worship him, forgives sins. I mean, this is shocking. This is radical that someone would appear in the context of Judaism and claim to be Yahweh, that he is this God, the sole creator of the universe. It there's no comparison with any other religious context.
Ken Samples is our guest. Another 10 minutes on the other side of the break, part one of a three-part daily series on the Christian worldview today, the resurrection, and of course we're talking right now about the incarnation of Jesus Christ. We'll get to the biblical testimony about Jesus' true divinity and true humanity after this.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Thursday afternoon, June the 7th. Ken Samples is our guest. We're talking about the incarnation of Jesus Christ as one of those truths that transforms the world, our series on the Christian worldview. Ken, let's talk about, briefly if we could, about the biblical, you kind of stepped in that direction, but the biblical testimony with regard to the true divinity, the full divinity, and the full humanity of this man, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, when you look at the New Testament, Jesus goes around acting as if he's God. I mean, he says these incredible things that to relate to him is like relating to God. If you love him, you love God. If you hate him, you hate God. To trust in him, believe in God, believe also in me. So very clearly, Jesus goes around giving people the direct impression that just as they would relate to Yahweh, that they have to relate to him that way. And this is incredibly powerful in the context, again, of first century Judaism. But you also see it in the reaction that people have to him. I mean, not only in John 8, where he claims to be the great I Am, and this sacred name of God in the book of Isaiah, you see that God refers to himself as I Am or I Am He. He has this debate, this argument with the Jewish religious leaders. They finally become frustrated and say, "Who are you?" And he says, "Before Abraham came into being, I Am." They pick up stones to stone him. So not only is Jesus making these claims, but the people are reacting to him, that he is, in fact, claiming this kind of context. And then, again, this further point that he also seems to have the prerogatives of deity, that who can forgive sin but God alone? But Jesus forgives people's sin. You know, who would allow people to worship him except God? Jesus allows the apostles to worship him. And so this supporting evidence is very powerful, that Jesus really had a self-identity, that he was God in human flesh, and the New Testament gives him these titles. He's called Lord. He is called the Son of God, the Son of Man. All of these titles really convey the idea that Jesus is God in human flesh.
Where does that leave those searching for an alternative explanation for the life of Christ?
Well, it's really interesting, I think, that, you know, when you look at these questions, you have to come to some kind of conclusion. I mean, was he a liar? I mean, did he invent all of this? Did he know that he wasn't God, and was he then just lying about it? Or, you know, was he a lunatic? I mean, I mean, people who claim to be God, we often think that, you know, they need a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Or did he mean it in an Eastern mystical way? I think when we begin to look at these explanations, again, this idea of abductive reasoning, what is the best explanation for all of this phenomenon? I mean, it's just inconceivable to think that the person who's had some of the greatest impact in the world in terms of morality would be lying about his identity, or to think that Jesus could give the Sermon on the Mount, but then be a person who had deep psychological problems. I mean, this just is not consistent. I mean, as shocking, as amazing as it is, the best explanation seems that God actually visited Earth, that he walked the Earth, and so, again, I would argue that it's an amazing thing, but I think the best explanatory hypothesis is that the apostles really encountered God in human flesh.
We don't have time to deal with all of them, but how do you deal with the most popular, again, the default position, which is Jesus never made any claims such as you were saying, but later words were put in his mouth, and he eventually grew in the minds of his followers centuries later to a proportion that he never claimed for himself, namely God and man?
I think that is a very difficult case to make when it comes to the Apostle Paul, when it comes to Paul's early experiences, when Paul in various of his epistles compares Jesus to Yahweh in the Old Testament. I think it is it's very clear. Even the non-Christian authors at the end of the first century are claiming that the church worshiped Jesus as God. And so maybe if we had a couple hundred years and we were able to see this kind of evolution where Jesus's deity kind of evolved, but we don't have that. I mean, even some of the most liberal scholars realize how primitive Paul's experiences were, and how exalted the titles that he gives them. I mean, when Jehovah's Witnesses walk into my house, Todd, I just look at them and say, "Look, if I can show you that the things that are true of Yahweh, or in their terms, Jehovah, are true of Jesus, what would that tell you?" And so, you know, I just don't think that history and time and evidence is on the side of the liberal theologians. Jesus's deity is something that begins right at the beginning of this Christian movement.
With only a minute here, Ken, if in fact God has revealed himself in human flesh, in the person of Jesus Christ, what does that truth mean for the whole world? 1 minute.
Well, I mean, this is staggering. I mean, the problem with all of the religions is, again, this question, who speaks for God? But the problem is they all contradict each other, and, you know, we have difficulty sorting it out. But imagine this idea that God himself came on the scene of human history, could be heard, could be encountered. There's nothing more important than hearing this message and taking into account what might he have me do? What is my relationship with him? What is the message that Jesus gave in his death on the cross? And so, again, I think that we as Christians have gotten used to these ideas. We're comfortable with them, but they're shocking. They're revolutionary, and we need to take these kinds of arguments out to an unbelieving world and convey to them that you don't have to go looking. You don't have to go to India to look for God. God has come looking for us in the person of Jesus Christ.
Ken, we're going to continue our series on the Christian worldview tomorrow, talking about cosmology, creation, and arguments for the existence of God. With about 30 seconds, what's on tap for tomorrow?
Well, you know, as we look again at these questions, we realize that Christianity makes all kinds of other claims. It claims that the universe was created by God, that there's evidence pointing to God, that most meaningful realities tend to make sense of God. And so I try to stack these up and show them just how powerful the Christian worldview is in making these claims.
Ken Samples is senior research scholar at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California, author of the new book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. Check it out at our website, issuesetc.org. Go to Listen on Demand. Ken, thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Folks, we have just 23 days left before many congregations are going to begin their new fiscal year on July 1st. Use those 3-plus weeks well by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Go tonight, download a 1-page flyer on the Issues Etc. 300. It's our congregational support program. Congregations that support Issues Etc. to the tune of $1,000 or more in their mission or advertising budget. The 1-page flyer tells you all you need to know and all your congregation needs to know. Time is getting short to ask your congregation to include Issues Etc. in its budget, but you can do so before that July 1st deadline for many congregations. IssuesETC.org. Click support. You'll find the 1-page flyer. Find out everything you need to know and take it to your congregation. Ask them to join the Issues Etc. 300. We do get used to it. We have gotten used to it. This notion that God has, in fact, revealed himself in his fullness in the person of Jesus Christ, God and man. That in itself would be a claim, were it true, that would change everything, right? It is true. It does change everything. And this God-man, Jesus Christ, came not simply to stand there as we ogle him or to teach us some great truth from the great beyond, but he came to affect our salvation precisely by taking our fallen nature, our sin upon himself. He himself being sinless, bearing our sin in its fullness in that body on the cross. To lay down his life for us, for the whole world, and to give his life to us. And if that were true, doesn't that change everything? Well, it is true. It is a fact. It is history. And it does change everything. First and foremost, it changes God's disposition with us. That now this God who loves the world so much that he gives his son, that the world might not come under his condemnation or his judgment, has in fact saved the whole world through him. Were this true, there's nothing more important to believe. There's nothing more important in your life. And it is true. And there is nothing more important to believe, and there is nothing more important in your life. Not just you, but for the whole world. I mean, that is the scope of Jesus' own claim. Sooner or later, those who doubt, those who are skeptical, those who offer their alternate explanations for this man, Jesus Christ, and his claim to lay down his life for the world in a sacrifice at the cross and take it up again in his resurrection, sooner or later, those who are skeptical, those who offer alternate explanations, got to deal with him. They have to deal with Jesus himself. Now, they can offer an alternate explanation, but they're going to find themselves arguing with Jesus. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
By grace I'm saved.
Grace, God's favor because of what Christ has done for you. This is precisely the gift that you will receive at Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church in Strasburg, Illinois. God's grace delivered by the means appointed by our Lord Himself, His word proclaimed and His sacraments rightly administered. Come and receive. Grace, it's not just what we believe, it's who we are. Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church in Strasburg, Illinois.